Welcome to the WFO Life Podcast. Buckle up for interviews, insights, and practical discussions, and the occasional intellectual oddity, all designed to help you master self, master craft, and accomplish any life mission.
Welcome back to the WFO Life Podcast. Dr. William Curtis here, and I have Lieutenant Colonel Chris Story, as always, on the other end in Pennsylvania. And we are talking today about a Netflix series, or I guess not a series, but it's a Netflix documentary that I came across and thought it'd be interesting conversation for the WFO Live podcast. That is a documentary called Social Dilemma. Chris, I know we took a look at this. How are you today?
Doing great. Just, excited that it seems like even the world up here in the Northeast is opening back up to normal. So it's been nice. So.
Yeah, I just traveled a lot this weekend prior to recording this, and it just seems, you know, pretty... Actually, when you go in places, I went into a big travel center like Bucky's, and it was so many people, it was actually a little unnerving after being, just sort of, you know, distanced from everyone. It was kind of interesting. But, you know, kind of feels like normal again, so... So you took a look at this documentary, and it's pretty interesting. I guess the generics of it are, if you haven't heard of this or seen it, it's called Social Dilemma. It is a Netflix documentary, as I mentioned. And it centers on a series of interviews that the documentary folks put together on that where they interviewed former developers or former executives for various social media platforms. So we're talking about things like Facebook, Pinterest, Twitter, you know, etc. And then they kind of weave in some, you know, it's kind of entertaining a little bit because they weave in like a family example, you know, so as they do the interviews, they have this sort of actors behaving like a family that are dealing with issues surrounding social media. So I guess, Chris, we'll just kind of kick that off. I mean, what's your thoughts on this?
You know, I thought from early on in the documentary, I was pretty captivated by it, mainly because of, you know, like you mentioned, some of the people they had on. And I thought they did a really good job of getting people that were, for the most part, at the ground level of a lot of these platforms. You know, like the one guy developed a like button at Facebook, you know, right. And another guy developed like, you know, I think Gmail and the Google Drive concept, you know, at right. Google. And so I thought that was compelling to me because these were people that were there kind of at the intelligent design of these, you know, platforms that are, you know, kind of taking over our lives, so to speak. So I thought that was, you know, immediately captivating to me because they didn't just get, you know, the disgruntled 2-year employee that just left like in 2018. I mean, these are people that were there in, you know, 2010, 2011, 2012 that were at the ground floor of how these things are designed. So that really interested me on how they put it together.
Yeah, actually one of them that was most interesting to me was the guy that was he was responsible for monetization of Facebook.
Yeah.
So, you know, when Facebook first got started as a social platform, you know, it built up popularity really quick due to its ability to connect people and have people interact with each other. But then at some point, you know, the question came up, well, we have to make money with this. So, you know, exactly how are we going to make money? And so this guy that they interviewed was in charge of that process for up to 5 years early on. And he's the one that came up with this whole concept that we know about now that they cover in great detail in the documentary where, you know, essentially the people using the platform become the product.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, it's like they're using our... You know, the capability of analyzing our behaviors on social media, the things we like, the things we don't like, the things we comment on, the people we interact with, every little nuance of our lives, they can start to build this sort of avatar of our behavior, and then they match advertisement to that. And so, in a sense, it becomes this marketing machine that almost guarantees the people that want to advertise to you and me using those platforms that it's like almost guaranteed that we're going to be drawn in because they already know what our interests are to begin with.
Yeah, it was fascinating. I mean, for all the reasons that, you know, that you laid out, and I think it was Tristan Harris was kind of the guy that was, I guess, the most prominent throughout the documentary. And I think one of the most introspective things he said early on is that, you know, when it first came out, like you mentioned with Facebook, it was just a way for everybody to connect.
Right.
And then they went into the monetization. But, you know, they mentioned a lot of the good things. I mean, you know, organ donors, you know, have found each other, lost family members, you know, kids that were, you know, separated at birth, and all the kind of cool things that can come out of this network that never existed before. But they said that quickly as it, you know, grew, people began to use it differently than even the developers had expected. And right. So it kind of, you know, took on a life of its own. And then, you know, I think it, like I said, Tristan Harris was the one I had a note on. It talks about the ethical design of it, because they, you know, in some cases didn't really, I guess, map it out very well of how it would be used, especially as they started to monetize it, right? And so that, like, right. I think one of the terms he used for what you're talking about was a surveillance capitalism, where like, you know, they almost don't care in a way, like, you know, what you like or don't like, but just your behaviors and how that can be, you know, tracked and monetized. And so they said that quickly, you know, as it grew, they started to realize, or some of the people started to realize, there's some ethical concerns of what it was creating. So,
yeah, and another part of that is that one of the things they didn't realize, and I think it was the way they interviewed these individuals, it was very clear that you could just tell they were a little uncomfortable or maybe a little embarrassed by maybe what some of these platforms had become. You know, and one of them, I think, clearly stated, he said, you know, we never foresaw any of the things that some of this became. And I think part of that is because the platforms by design pull people into groups and then have them interact with each other. And when you do that, there's a lot of unintended consequences that occur. And you know, now Facebook and multiple social medias have been at the heart of major, you know, well, it's been at the heart of elections. They've impacted revolutions. They have impacted, you know, I know they've been implicated in, you know, various social uprisings and riots, and, you know, in some situations maybe for good, and then other situations just, you know, even in enhancing like terrorism and various aspects, you know, negative things that they never realized people would use these things for.
Yeah, I mean, like, I think the way they put it in the simplest term is that they were looking to build models that predicted action, which was, you know, simple enough. But then as people started to cluster in groups and create, you know, their own little Facebook communities, the problem was that whether it was a personality type or certain neuroses or, you know, extremist ideology, so what happened was it started just to create these like viral little groups. And so everybody, you know, whatever you believed or didn't believe, you know, you could start having these groups of people, because you think about when you have 2 billion users, even if what you think is pretty out there, you're probably going to be able to find like 5 or 10 people that are going to think the same way you do. And that wasn't always healthy, you know, and they didn't really, I don't think, foresee in some of these cases, like, you know, with like governments being able to use it as a manipulation tool and really, you know, start riots and revolutions and things like that. You know, they mentioned like Myanmar and the Philippines and some of these places that, I mean, really Facebook was the key enabler to allow, you know, some of these factions to, you know, meet up and create havoc. And so that's really, I think, where the genie was out of the bottle at that point, so to speak, and they realized, like, okay, maybe we have some ethical and moral dilemmas here. And now I think you see it swinging the other way, where like they're doing damage control, and so they're like canceling users and, you know, trying to come up with some AI technology that can, you know, when somebody mentions something, it can flag them. But that's not really that elegant of a solution either, because it flags like mundane things and then you get banned for, you know. And so I think right now they're really in a point where, I think towards the end of the documentary, they were saying, you know, we have to have some critical people to really help redefine, you know, what the future of these platforms look like. So,
yeah, because in a sense, there was not a lot of morality built into them for the most part, you know, except for maybe, you know, they would try to block pornography or block, you know, obviously abusive, morally reprehensible things, but they're not very successful at that. And then you're at the way the platforms and the way they have these algorithms behind the scenes that are doing a lot of this. So they have programmers writing really software on it's kind of like you're looking at yourself in a mirror, and they're trying to create this like avatar of you. They're trying to create a behavioral image of you so that they can predict what your next activities are. And they have computer programs that do this. And so when you what I kind of thought of when you said they put people in these groups, well, you start to see the things that you want to see.
Yeah.
You know, it starts to reflect you back at you. Yeah. And so what ends up happening is you can become in like a silo. You know how it feels like? I know you've seen this, but it seems like politically, if you just took politics, everybody's so much more segregated and like just in another world from other human beings. You know, they, you know, like it's like, you know, the whole Democrat Republican thing or liberal versus conservative. It's so divided. It's so far away ideologically now, or it seems that way.
Yeah.
That a lot of people get into these sort of silos in their social media where they think everyone thinks this way. Of course, well, everyone thinks this way, and that's not true.
Yeah, I mean, I think what you said is the most important part. It seems that way, and I think a lot of it is there's some crazy stats primarily on Twitter where 90% of the content is generated by 10% of the users. And right. So when you think about that, it's generally probably 5% at either extreme of the spectrum. You know, so right. If you're just like a casual user, like most of us are, that have real lives and real jobs, you know, we're not sitting there all day generating this content. But because it's curated and the AI knows like who we follow and, you know, what we've liked and what we've retweeted before, it, in your feed, it's going to show you all of those things that it knows is going to keep you on the platform longer, you know.
Right.
And so it really has no ethical outcome that it's trying to steer you towards. It just wants you to stay on there so they can advertise to you and, you know, and get your behavior. But the problem with that is, you know, regular people in the middle, probably the 80% in the middle, think that the country and topics are way more divided when, I mean, if you go to your kids like soccer game, or if you're like, you know, at a PTA meeting, even people that you know probably vote differently than you, they're really not as different from you as it appears because of the online chatter that you see. And it makes people honestly feel worse about what's going on in the world because of social media, which is a travesty, you know? I
mean, yeah, and as we continue talking about this social dilemma documentary, one of the things you mentioned earlier was about the content, you know, like some, you know, sometimes you're like in the silo and you're seeing like an image of what your likes and dislikes. And you mentioned that they're trying to get you to take action. That's the thing. They want you to take action to buy or interact with some type of product.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the important part because, and what's, I think, you know, some people have taken, you know, very drastic action based on the things that they're seeing. And literally, people can be manipulated into taking action. You know, ideally for Facebook or Twitter or whatever, it's for them to buy something, right?
Yeah.
But now what they're finding is people are taking action to go hurt other people, or they're going to take action politically, or they're, you know. And so they're realizing that, you know, little things that they do in these algorithms and the way that they're stacking and siloing people together can lead to these movements that they never, never expected.
Well, I was going to say that I think the documentary does a really good job of showing, you know, kids that are at the most vulnerable ages that are living on social media. You know, I think in the case of the documentary, it shows, you know, some kids that are having some issues and the online interaction is fueling it. And then they show up at like a protest that, you know, turns violent into a riot. Next thing you know, they're like zip tied and they're in a group, you know, with the cops like carrying them off to jail. And, you know, it was obvious from the intent of them to show up. Maybe they had, you know, a good reason to show up. You know, you can think of, you know, things that have happened over the past year, you know, people protesting on different sides, and that by itself, you know, can be a good thing. I mean, that's, you know, part of what living in a, you know, constitutional republic like America lets you do. But, you know, you don't know if you're going to show up, and it goes from, you know, a basic, you know, show of solidarity with a good cause, and then, you know, five people show up and start, you know, throwing rocks at the cops, and then you're like in the middle of it, and then, you know, the next thing you know, you're you know, on video, and you're right there, and, you know, it's hard to tell who was, you know, being violent, who wasn't, and then you end up in the back of a squad car, you know. So I think that was showing how you can get sucked into a movement, you know, not know anything about the background of these people you're showing up, you know, to support, and then, you know, you're in a bad situation. So I think that, you know, the documentary did a really good job, even though it was scary, talking about preteens and teens that get active on these platforms, and, you know, how the rates of depression and suicide, I mean, correlate almost exactly with, you know, how many people were joining these platforms at those ages. I think now they've kind of changed it where technically you're supposed to be of a certain age before you can even create an account, but that's pretty easy to fake, right? I mean,
right,
the kid,
right.
So I think that, I mean, that was where it became shocking for me as a parent of a 13, 11, and a 9-year-old, like, you know, I pretty much said that, you know, we're going to be the bad parents, but I'm like, hey, you know, you don't need a personal Facebook, you know, page, you know, pretty much with my 13-year-old, I was like, hey, unless something changes and I have more faith in it, I mean, I I know you're going to be isolated in a way, but you'll have less problems in another way, but I don't even want you to, you know, to have one until you're out of high school.
Right.
And so, you know, I know that's probably extreme and they'll miss out on some things, but I mean, if you look at just the empirical data, and I think they even mentioned on the documentary that the way they talked about it, that it was like digging into the kids' brainstem because they're so impressionable, and you know, they had Snapchat dysmorphia because they have these filters that make them look, you know, as pretty as they possibly can be, and they're like, oh, why can't I look like that in real life? And
right,
you know, it starts messing with you know, their psyche when they're most impressionable. So it's scary.
Yeah,
so
there was a few things that when I was watching it, I actually took notes as I was watching because I knew we were going to do a little, you know, episode on it. And one of the things that struck me that I think anybody that, even if you never watched this documentary, know these three things about the way all of these social platforms are designed. So if you use one of these, just know this is happening. The first one, they are addicting. They were designed that way. Okay. The people who design them know they are addicting. In fact, many of them don't allow their families or themselves to use them, okay? Because they know they were designed by behavioral experts, people who know exactly how neurobehavior works and how the brain functions. And so they actually put steps in place to kind of feed our, you know, normal functioning parts of the brain to want to continue using them. So that's one thing to, you know, those are actually two things. I had them as two: addicting, first off, but yeah, then that the fact that these were designed by behavioral experts, period, end stop. And then the last of those three was that I thought was a huge takeaway for anyone that hasn't seen this: everything you do on those social platforms, everything. In fact, they can see where your eyes are scanning on your computer or your phone screen. Everything you do, see, or scroll past is recorded and timed and logged. Mm. And so every moment you spend there, they are gathering information about you, and no, you can't hide from it if you're on the platforms.
Yeah. I mean, it's I jotted down some of the stats, and, you know, some of the people that were, like I said, at the forefront of this technology, some of the words they used were frightening to me, you know, as a parent of, you know, kids in that kind of vulnerable population, is that, you know, one, just as humans, even though we've evolved, you know, we are not an evolved enough creature in a way to understand and to be able to take in the opinions of thousands of people, you know, and how that affects like our self-image, right?
Right.
And I think some of the terms that stuck out at me that one of the Facebook gurus early on was talking about, it creates a fake brittle popularity. And they had stats on, the kids are more anxious, they're more fragile, they're less likely to take risks, you know, even to the point where lowering numbers of kids that even ever want to get a driver's license, kids in high school that have actually been on a date, which is crazy to me. You think about, that's the first few things as we were growing up, like,
right,
you want to turn 16, yeah, 16, get your license and, go on a real date with somebody.
An actual person.
Yeah, and so now, you think about it, it's creating these bubbles where, and I'm sure there's a pornography piece of that where, it's like, okay, I don't want to take risks of, trying to go out and have a relationship with an actual person, when I can sit at home and create this, like, false reality, and get stimulation and a lot of, whether it be games or pornography or just right. social media likes. And literally, they said social media is killing people. It was like a 151% suicide increase in preteen girls, like, before and after, social
pre-teen
media.
Preteen girls. Yeah, that's the thing. Preteen girls. That struck me too, is yeah. I'm looking at this thinking, okay, and you can see they did this graphical
where
when social media started sort of 2008 through about 2011, you see this just trajectory upwards, like you said, is 170% or something like yeah. that increase in suicide rates.
Yeah.
And that's not a fluke. Those yeah. things are tied together. That was the major, change and it was the advent and access to cell phones and of course social media. So that's just, it's scary. And like one of the authors or one of the people said that they were interviewing, is nobody sets out to want their kid to have any of these risks. Like, no. I don't want my kids to have any of these risks. But the thing that gets me, I think we did a little talk on mindfulness and stuff here recently. One of the things that stands out to me about social platforms like this and just being online generally and kind of in the cyber world is that we are, by doing so, mindfulness is a very healthy thing. And in fact, I'm reading a book right now called Full Catastrophic Living by Jon Kabat-Zinn. Very awesome book if you haven't read that. But the idea is it's teaching all the different ways to be mindful. And being mindful means just being quiet with yourself and reflecting maybe on, thinking less, reflecting more on how your body feels and kind of settling into yourself and not having as much external stimuli, not allowing your mind to sort of run down rabbit holes and constantly working on projects, right? Well, social media directly, like, is counter to that. It strives to keep the monkey mind that we've talked about before on this show. It strives to keep the monkey mind plugged in and engaged, punching out widgets, getting the little dopamine hit from the little rewards and dings and bells and stars and hearts and all the things that go off, the emojis that go off whenever these things happen. That is by definition keeping us out of that contemplated deeper thought wave. Instead, it's keeping us in a place where we're just constantly being sort of an autopilot where the monkey mind is sort of running away with things. So I think that's another aspect that I don't think is healthy. Most of the people I run across need more time meditating. They need more time with mindfulness. They need to unplug more and less doing and more just simply existing and being. And I find that social media directly fuels that tendency.
Yeah, I try to have a mostly healthy relationship with social media, with mm-hmm. And I think it's part of trying to practice being mindful about things. Like, when I go into it, I think the more, you watch documentaries like The Social Dilemma, you read and, exercise your body and mind in different ways. Not that it doesn't still draw you in some cases, but I think you can use it in a healthy way and create sort of a buffer on, like, what you will and won't do,
right.
on the platform. But, the sad part about it, you can sit there and see people by what they're posting and then just, like, reposting, that they're in a bad way. In a lot of ways, it's driven by social media. I know some friends and family members that I'm like, I don't even know what the hell they're doing, because like you'll just see a stream of it's not even any of their own pictures or content. They're just like liking and sharing and reposting things that are just all from TikTok and other people, and I'm like, at some point, do you have your own thoughts, or are you right. just like, and I think it goes back to what we said earlier, it's like you have this curated stream of things that come to your various social media, you know, home screens, and then you just sit there for hours and liking and reposting and commenting on things, and it's like at some point you lose your identity of who you are, you know. Yeah. And it may be like 10% of you is identifying with some of this stuff, but I mean, it's scary. And you know, one of the things they talk about it along those lines in the documentary is that it becomes like a digital pacifier, you know, that makes it harder for you to deal with real problems, because you're in this world of like everything, you know, looks shiny and has a filter, and nobody posts about, you know, when they get a bad blood test back from the doctor. They only post about when they're going on vacation, or when their kid got straight A's, or when, you know, their kid made the all-star team. And so, you know, you think it's like, oh, well, I guess I suck as a parent because, you know, I have real life stuff going on. And that's not the case, but people tend to share and like and, you know, talk about things that make them, you know, appear in the best light possible, when that doesn't really reflect real life. You know, that's another fantasy about it, right? I mean, so
yeah, for sure. You know, and I mean, we've listed, you know, I think my general take on social media after watching this is be very wary, be very scared of this. Not scared, but, you know, very vigilant for it. And one of the things that you know, dawned on me, though, is like I had stopped using Twitter after the last election because I just didn't like some of the way, you know, these companies can manipulate things. I didn't like some of the ways they were manipulating content and stuff. Mm-hmm. And that told me, I just said, look, this is a company that has all this power and they're able to manipulate messaging. I didn't like that, so I got off of it. But one of the things I didn't, I ultimately went back to Twitter after about 8 or 9 months because there are positives about these.
For sure, you know, all of them.
You mentioned that at the beginning. There's a lot of positives to them. And one of them, I like Twitter. I like it because I can find things that are inspiring to me, that give me, if you carefully curate what you're looking at and you choose not to absorb, you know, large amounts of negativity and things like that, you can purposely choose things that are very uplifting, because there's a lot of positive people out there.
Yeah,
and,
absolutely.
But you have to curate that. You have to, it's like weeding your garden, you know, like a Twitter feed is like a garden. And you have to, if you find things that creep into it that are like, it's not that you're Pollyanna or that you're trying to avoid negativity in the world, but it's just important to not let yourself be drowned in, you know, some of the things that are being pushed at you. Because like you said, or one of us had said earlier about wanting you to take action, a lot of what is put in front of you by these algorithms, by the people that have designed these programs, is things that make you want to take action. And sometimes that action makes you mad.
They want
to elicit something, and if they know they can elicit anger, anger will cause a response. It's one of the most important ways they can trigger action is through anger. And so you have to be careful. If you find yourself being upset and you know, irritated or off to a bad start every day because you've checked your Twitter feed or your Facebook feed and it just pisses you off when you go on there, then perhaps you should do what I call media fasting. You know, I wrote a topic about that a while back. I think we've talked about it numerous times on this show. And, you know, we talked about it as a tool for stress management. And one of the things, sometimes you just have to be away from these things. And if you're excessively finding things negative, then perhaps that's you being, it's reflected back at you. And maybe you should just spend less time there and maybe focus on where that's coming from in yourself.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's so many lessons to learn of, you know, what we just chatted about, and I would encourage anybody listening to watch this, you know, with your spouse and maybe with your older kids, or even, you know, there's probably like a sweet spot in there. You know, maybe if you have a 11 or 12 year old that gets it, I don't think there's any really bad content in there, but I know towards the end of it, all the people that were interviewed got pretty philosophical, and I know I took a bunch of notes at the end, and you know, they talked about is this the last generation to know what real life was like? You know, somebody said that and I was like, wow. I mean, you know, when you think about the past year especially, I mean, if we have another pandemic or, you know, if some, you know, version of this that we lived in the past year gets worse, or, you know, political winds of change. I mean, yeah, that was like the perfect storm, you know, people not interacting with other people because the government said they couldn't. And then on top of it, they were living in this like social media echo chamber. So when he said that, you know, is this the last generation to know what real life was like? He said it's like, you know, the whole, there's like two roads. I mean, you know, one of them is like utopia, one of them is a complete dystopia. And, right, you know, the bigger these things get, the harder they are to change course. And as they get more powerful and ingrained in the political, you know, centers of power, that's even scarier. You know, they're so wealthy, you know, they can fund campaigns and, you know, get people to, you know, pass legislation that enables them to, you know, do more of what they're already doing. Yeah, I mean, I think another big takeaway is, you know, these people that invented the technology were just talking about something simple as like, you have to turn off all the notifications because it's almost like, I think one guy said, like keeping cookies in your pocket, you know, like, right, like right. if you want to get, you know, fat and diabetes. And so he's like, you know, it's one thing to have your calls and your texts, you know, on, but he said, other than that, you really should have all notifications turned off.
Right.
And they talked about the danger of liking videos on YouTube and, you know, liking or retweeting, you know, things on Facebook and Twitter. It's like you have to be careful because, you know, the AI is smarter than you are. I mean, because it, like you said, I mean, it's watching what you're watching. It's looking at your eye movement in some cases. So, I mean, there's these supercomputers that are set up, you know, to keep you on it, the platform, you know, mm-hmm. in some cases make you happy, get you outraged. And so, you know, not to just be paranoid, but it's like, hey, you know, the behaviors that you're having, you know, can really, you know, help curate things that are going to influence how you see the world. And like I said, it's even more scary when you talk about people in their formative years and, you know, the rates of depression and anxiety that's really not warranted in a lot of cases. You know, the kids just have this false sense of, you know, where they should be in life. And, you know, if they spent more time outside and, you know, interacting with people in person, you know, they'd probably avoid some of this stuff.
Yeah, and case in point, I wanted to mention something I found while I was researching this topic. I found an article from the Epoch Times. This was from May 28th, 2021, so this is very recent. The title was from the Media and Big Tech section. Facebook whistleblower leaks vaccine hesitancy censorship documents. So let me set this up. So it echoes what we've been talking about, how these companies are able to manipulate things. And, you know, for better or worse, someone at these facilities is, they're deciding what will be posted and what will not be posted. So in this instance, a Facebook whistleblower has leaked documents that appear to expose the tech giant's plans to censor content that shows COVID-19 as, quote, vaccine hesitancy, end quote. So they go on to say in here, there was a part I wanted to read, that essentially what they were doing is they were writing into the algorithms. Remember, this is the computer software that sort of assigns a score to whatever you post or whatever you say, and if it's related towards COVID-19, they actually wrote into the algorithm basically what this. It says anything that questions the vaccine or the narrative regarding the vaccine, which is, you know, everyone should get the vaccine and the vaccine is good and you're not going to get any bad side effects. Anything outside of that realm is basically considered, quote, vaccine hesitancy, end quote, by Facebook's algorithms. So the idea is that even if there was somebody that posted, I had a bad side effect, I'm concerned, or I'm a researcher or a medical doctor, and I have done research, and I think, and I'm, by the way, I'm not saying that there is in this case, I'm just saying if someone did have some type of real evidence, scientific evidence, that there was a problem with the vaccine or something like that, this company is basically, can with a code of, you know, little computer code, they can actually make that removed from the realm of Facebook where everybody might see it. So in a sense, they're controlling messaging, and they could control, they could be controlling something that's, you know, false, which I guess would be good if we know what truth is. But then in some situations, they could be controlling something that is not true, and they're shaping the narrative. They're controlling the people who read it. They're making them think what they want them to think, just like they did during elections.
Well, I was going to say, we saw it over the past year, and now as more info comes out, you could tell there was political motivations for how they were controlling, you know, certain, you know, topics, just like you're talking about, right? I mean, because, you know, one side was a proponent of, you know, masks or no masks, or one side was, you know, more, I guess, supporting a certain origin story of how the virus came about. And a lot of those things are turning out to be opposite of the stuff that was being filtered, you know, back, you know, 6 or 8 months ago. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I think that's the problem when it's one thing. It's like, I think they should either just let it go, you know, right, and be a free for all, or, you know, have hard data, you know, before you're just censoring people. Because there were some cases, I think, on YouTube where there was like a forum of virologists that were just, you know, had a different point of view than the standard wisdom. But right, they had, I mean, they were credentialed doctors, you know, from right, respected backgrounds and institutions. And so even though, I mean, if the government's not doing it, you can't say it's like a First Amendment violation. But in some cases, I mean, I've heard it where people think these social media platforms should almost be regulated like public utilities, right? Because, I mean, mm-hmm, if the main way people get access to information now is via YouTube and social media, if you're like filtering a point of view, you know, it's kind of hard to argue. Well, that, you know, you're at least making it harder for people to exercise their First Amendment rights. And even though it's not the government, you know, you have to be careful because, like I said, a lot of these things, you know, really in the past few months, that, like I said, were filtered by social media, it's like, oh, well, you know, maybe the virus did come out of a Chinese lab, you know, and or maybe the mask thing was just to make people feel better, you know, when
yeah,
a lot
it's
of
all coming full circle now, and they're starting these stories come back out.
Yeah, and so I think that's what, and you can't, like, you know, put the genie back in the bottle, right? So all these people that were deplatformed and, you know, had their content filtered, and now, I mean, they're being, you know, vindicated. But right, at this point, you know, we're past elections, we're past, you know, policies being made by states and school boards on, you know, what to do with kids in school and masks. And so, you know, I'm always, I think, you know, going back to, I guess, the founding of our country, it's like there's a reason why there's protections for freedom of speech, and you let the court of public opinion, you know, decide, okay, you know, it's like the flat earthers, you know, you quickly can dismiss these people. And I think now, I mean, there's so much access to information, you know, people could almost do it better now than they could when you had to wait and read a bunch of newspapers for a week,
sure,
you know.
Sure.
So I think that I would rather err on the side of the way some of these other, you know, emerging platforms are doing. It's like, hey, you know, we're not going to let people sell drugs and exploit children and do whatever on our platform, but we're not going to take a side in things that, you know, potentially have information that supports it either way. And I think that's the problem that a lot of the people in Congress are having. It's like, hey, it's fine if you do nothing, but if you're going to, like, filter and deplatform people, you know, what's your standard? And I think that's, they've had a hard time proving, like, you know, it's a kind of arbitrary, you know, and like they blame AI and say, oh, well, the AI flagged it, and then they put the people back up. And you look at it, it's like, really? The AI flagged this, but not that? You know, so, you know, I think we are in a place where, you know, like one of the people in the documentary said it, the survival of us, I mean, in general, you know, as humans, the way we've, you know, made it this far, in the light of social media, it's like, hey, we have to get out of this corrosive business model that a lot of these platforms, you know, got successful using, and use like valid criticism to drive improvements in right. these things. Because the way it is now, I mean, our kids are, you know, mentally sicker, you know, and physically weaker, honestly, than, you know, a lot of previous generations. And, you know, people are using this to, you know, meet each other up for, you know, nefarious intent. So, right. I mean, we have to find a way to either, you know, completely break the business model, or, you know, just have some significant improvements so that it can, you know, go back to what we started the discussion with. It's like, hey, you know, connect with people, you know, put out there, hey, my kid, I'm trying to raise money because my kid's getting cancer treatment, you know, go to this GoFundMe, you know, page, right. you know, all the good things you see, you know, need to stay, but all the other stuff, you know, you don't want it to be like Lord of the Flies, like we've seen, I think, over the past couple years. So,
yeah, and I think, I guess, as we close this out, I think it's about encouraging, you know, as a person that's trying to live a WFO life pot, you know, lifestyle where you're mastering yourself, mastering craft, accomplishing any life mission, I think it's important. The underscore here is not throw everything out.
Yeah.
I think that it's about critical thinking. I think we need to be more responsible for what we think and have our own thoughts. I was just reading a book here recently, and it was talking about this concept of so many people don't think their voice matters. Your thoughts matter. Your beliefs matter, and what opinions you have do matter. And you should be willing to listen to your own mind and not let something external make that mind, you know, research things for yourself. If something seems strange, if you feel emotionally provoked by something, you should explore why that is. Is this even real? Is there other resources that I could look at and maybe search that would help me understand if this is real or not real? And if so, let me make up my own mind and not just take their word for it. I think that's a big danger, is a lot of people just take the word for whatever they read online because it's got to be true. And that is not always the case. And I think, you know, just skimming over this, you know, topic with this social dilemma documentary underscores the fact that you have to be careful with these platforms. But I think people who think for themselves and are willing to use critical thinking and develop that as a skill, I think can get some of the benefits of these platforms without exposing themselves to as much of the negativity. Or I could be wrong, and, you know, this is all going down the tubes. I'm not sure.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think for, I mean, maybe in a protective way, I think a lot of us, hopefully, that were born, you know, maybe in the 70s and early 80s, we didn't grow up with this in our formative years, right. and we can put it in perspective. But I think I worry most about, you know, like the stats show, the kids that are in their most vulnerable years when they're trying to figure out who they are as people. And I think that those are the people that are the most negatively impacted by this and that have to be protected. And I don't know the best way to do that, because obviously, you know, you want your kids to be tech savvy and, you know, be able to do things and embrace the technology, but not at the detriment of their mental health like we're seeing. So, I mean, it's like a slippery slope. You know, you don't want your kid to be a complete shut-in, you know, electronically, but you also, you know, don't want them to open Pandora's box whenever they, you know, push an app on their phone. So it's got to be Absolutely. A happy median. So,
well, I guess as we wrap this up, I'm going to say something, and then no one will ever hear this podcast. I'm going to say, hey, algorithm, vaccine hesitancy score. Okay. I said it. So maybe folks that are listening to this, share it, and let's see if this becomes a very popular episode, or maybe no one will ever hear it.
We'll completely see. Filtered. So.
Yeah, it'll get completely filtered out. So yeah. No one will ever hear our commentary on the social Good dilemma times. Documentary. All right, Chris, let's hold out there. And I guess if you want to connect with us or share your thoughts, obviously we'd love you to share this podcast with friends and family. And also, if you have some ideas or thoughts of your own, we'd love to chat with you in the WFO Life Tribe inside of the Future Focus Health Network. We always put that in the show notes, and I encourage you to follow the podcast. Make sure you don't miss any of our exclusive content, and make sure that you get the episodes as they come out right away. So, Chris, have a great night.
Yep, this was fun. See you next time.